At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A press release from the Federal Reserve might seem like a strange place to start, especially one loaded down with Fed speak and indecipherable acronyms. Ordinarily, we'd go nowhere near it. But today, Bernanke and Company came clean, and they said what everybody has known for a while now. The banking system is going to need a little more help. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing people-ready enterprise solutions, software based on how people really work, and by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 3rd of February. Great to have you with us. And we're going to spare you the text of the Fed's whole announcement this morning and just paraphrase the relevant line. It goes something like this, that the Fed is going to extend its liquidity programs in light of continuing substantial strain in financial markets. That last part there, by the way, is a direct quote. In English, it means that Chairman Ben Bernanke is going to keep the lifeline of cash to the banking system that it's had in place for more than a year now. And our senior business correspondent Bob Moon points out today's action is a pretty good sign the Fed is nowhere near weaning the banks off his emergency treatment.
After all this time, the patient remains under intensive care. With a steady flow of medication, some of which the Fed has been providing for more than a year. Its initial treatments extended 2, 3, and even 4 times now. Peter Morisi is an economist at the University of Maryland. He says Chairman Bernanke and company essentially decided again today the patient remains unstable.
What the Federal Reserve right now is doing is providing life support or emergency room services to the banks, and we need some sort of clinical program to rehabilitate them and get them healthy again.
If you sense frustration, Morisi points out the diagnosis has been the same for a long time. The patient's being poisoned by toxic loans that need to be cut out.
Quite simply, the Treasury and the Fed will be perpetually underwriting the banks and securities companies until they come up with a program to remove from the books of these institutions all of this questionable paper and to work them out. That is to do triage in the loans, reworking some, letting others foreclose, and leaving still others that will be repaid alone.
The banks aren't making those kinds of tough but necessary triage decisions, so Stanford University economist Michael Boskin says it's long past time for the government to start wielding the knife.
That's the single best thing we can do to get the financial system back to health again. I think that we're going through that process way too slowly, and the longer we wait, the longer this will be drawn out.
And perhaps the more likely the banks could develop an unhealthy dependency on the Fed's medication. But at Duke University, business law professor Bill Brown says the banks don't seem to be hooked so far.
If they ever really started lending this extra $800 billion on out into the economy, they might get addicted to these programs, but it's very clear they're not addicted yet.
Brown says until lending levels return to normal, the treatment is likely to continue. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
So about that lending Bob was talking about, remember this financial crisis started as a credit crunch. And we've been hearing for, it seems like, forever that banks just won't lend. Statistics from the Fed appear to back that up, showing most commercial banks are indeed tightening their lending standards. All the while, two different presidential administrations have been doing their darndest to convince banks to start lending again and help repair the economy. But there is some equally persuasive evidence out there that throughout last year, even as the credit crisis took hold, banks were still extending credit, and plenty of it, too. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
The Fed says during the final 3 months of last year, commercial banks increased their lending by 2.36%. Still, most credit in the U.S. actually doesn't come directly from banks. Octavio Morenzi heads financial services consulting firm Celent. He says other sources of credit have dried up.
All the securitized markets have certainly suffered. Mortgage-backed securities, we see much less of. We see much less of certain sort of exotic kinds of credit derivatives like CDOs or CLOs and things like that.
All those securities let consumers extend their credit. Now the market for them has all but collapsed. But Simon Johnson of MIT's Sloan School of Management says the statistics on bank lending don't tell the whole story. He says it's definitely tougher to get a loan these days.
If you think of there being three types of borrowers, really creditworthy, medium creditworthy, and somewhat dubious. The really creditworthy, I would say, don't want to borrow. The medium creditworthy are getting squeezed by the banks, and the very dubious people are not able to borrow at all.
He says big companies and debt-laden consumers are cutting costs as they steel themselves for the recession. And as the desire to borrow shrinks, banks are likely to further rein in their lending. So
when I hear people, for example, in Congress saying, we must force the banks to lend, that makes me very worried, because who exactly are they going to lend to?
Johnson says small businesses are the only viable candidates. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
As good a game as the Super Bowl was this year, as usual, it was the ads that gave us a peek into American culture. This year, they were all about coping with recession, as in this one. Avon calling, not for customers, but for sales reps.
I can't get fired. I can't get laid off. It's my business.
The company announced higher fourth quarter profits today, though a bit less than expected, which got us wondering whether a recession might be the right time to start a home-based business. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
One of the women in the Avon Super Bowl ad is actual Avon lady Darren Dezengatita. She says it's a great business, and not just because she can't get fired.
There are two things that women are never going to go without, and that would be moisturizer and lipstick.
Dezengatita admits the recession has made new customers harder to come by, but she says those who know her are buying more.
I've seen an increase in my average order.
Avon Communications VP Joe Ballone says the number of reps grew last year by 7% to around 6 million.
We made a decision about a year ago that we were going to step up our presence to let people know about the opportunity that Avon offers to run your own business.
It doesn't cost Avon anything to add reps. Even so, the company admits 2009 will be a challenging year. In this global recession, customers have less spending money. But marketing strategist Susan Planka says home-based entrepreneurs may have an advantage over faceless mall stores.
Clients might be hesitant to go out to the malls, but if their friend will help them, customers might be more open to that.
Home-based businesses can also supplement a sagging savings account. Kathy Weir started selling Mary Kay cosmetics 4 months ago. She wanted to earn money to go to her brother's wedding in Puerto Rico.
My first month that I was in, I was able to buy my plane tickets.
That pink Mary Kay car can't be far off. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Buyers came calling on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Just because you're getting email from the President of the United States, it doesn't mean you're on his secret BlackBerry access list or anything. Millions of emails from the President were sent out to supporters all across the country yesterday, probably to the exact same mailing list that he used to drum up contributions during the campaign. This time, President Obama is asking supporters to get together and talk about the economic stimulus bill that's working its way through Congress. As Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, it's the latest attempt to turn an online political campaign that went viral into a policy movement.
Democrats are hoping to convert Obama's online lists into a permanent force for change. A Elaine Young is a marketing professor at Champlain College.
Nobody's done it before.
Democrats asked online supporters to host house parties this weekend as part of the drive to pass the stimulus plan. Young's following the effort, but she's skeptical.
In houses around the country, people are sitting around their dinner table talking about economic recovery. Like, I just got my pink slip today is their conversation. So I'm not sure that this is actually the right way to leverage that. It's one thing to do it around a campaign. The question is, how do you take that same energy and put it into moving policy?
We need a better understanding of exactly what the outcome of these meetings is going to be.
Amit Malhotra has hosted these parties in the past, but when he got the email yesterday, he decided to take a pass.
If it's just to bring people together and snap some photos and upload them to the website.
It won't cut it, at least for Malhotra. But in Iowa City, Karen Nichols is on board. She expects 30 guests at her home, and she's planning to write her Republican senator, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, and ask him to get behind the stimulus bill.
Some people have already done so in our group.
Officials at the Democratic National Committee won't say just yet exactly what they'll ask supporters to do next, but Elaine Young's guessing they'll ask folks to call their elected representatives. And already, thousands of people have signed up to take part. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marathon Oil released earnings today. The numbers gave investors a bit of a shock. No ExxonMobil record-breaking billions here. Red Ink, in fact. One of the biggest factors in the quarterly loss was a $1.4 billion write-down of something called goodwill, which means what exactly? Marketplace's Rico Galliano helps us out in today's installment of the Marketplace Decoder.
Okay, to understand the concept of goodwill, let's cast our minds back to the heady days of the dot-com era.
Investors were buying dreams.
That's James Angel, finance professor at Georgetown University.
Many companies were little more than an idea in somebody's laptop computer. Yet, many investors were willing to pay good money to invest in those companies because they expected those companies to go out and make a lot of money in the future.
That value, the value of a company's future profit-making potential, is called goodwill. Goodwill is what makes the Coca-Cola company worth more than the value of all the bottling equipment and sugar water it owns. Or, okay, how's this for a metaphor?
If you think of a company as being like a work of fine art, the value of the painting is not the value of the paint and the brushes and the canvas. The value of the painting is what the market will pay for it.
In other words, goodwill is pretty subjective, but only up to a point. See, the moment a company is sold, accountants can assign an exact dollar value to its goodwill. They just add up the value of all the company's assets and subtract that from its selling price.
Then there's a leftover amount, which reflects the buyer probably paid more than the sum of the market values of all the individual pieces of the company. And that's called goodwill.
Here's the neat part. Let's say you bought that company. Its goodwill is now considered one of your assets. It appears on your balance sheet just like office equipment or company cars. And your accountants can calculate whether that goodwill value is increasing or decreasing. If the value decreases, you can put that down as an expense. And if an agency like Moody's suspects the value might decrease, they can downgrade your credit rating. At which point you might find yourself shopping at that other goodwill. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Coming up, the logic behind pushing plastic.
The credit card is the most profitable line right now in the banking industry, and they need to squeeze it from their perspective for everything they can get.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials padded up 141 points today, 1.75%, ended at 8,078. The NASDAQ gained 21 points, nearly 1.5%, finished at 1516. The S&P 500 rose 13 points, also about 1.5%, closed at 838. A surprise uptick in December pending home sales lifted construction stocks. D.R. Horton built up 21%. Luxury home builder Toll Brothers added on 6%. Merck Insuring Plow beat fourth quarter expectations. It was Welcome Medicine. Merck gained 6.3%. Insuring Plow plowed up 8.25%. They've been cutting costs, including thousands of jobs. The two remaining publicly traded members of Detroit's Big Three, that'd be Ford and General Motors, lost ground today as sales dropped by half. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the events for Wednesday. The USDA releases the 2007 Census of Agriculture. The Senate Banking Committee holds a hearing on how to modernize the banking regulatory system. And the future of green jobs is now. That's according to the folks heading up the Good Jobs, Green Jobs National Conference. Attendees will meet in Washington, D.C. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
One of the toughest parts of the job around here is squeezing an entire day's worth of news into just 30 minutes, so inevitably, a few bits get left on the cutting room floor. I spoke with Harvard researcher Susan Eaton last week about education and the Obama administration. One of the parts we had to leave out was her thoughts on testing. Jean Decker teaches fifth grade in Loomis, California, and she wrote asking why we hadn't talked about testing, which she says is one of the biggest problems in education, especially in cash-strapped districts like her own.
So field trips have been cut down, you know, music, art. It's just a 100% focus on math and reading. And in fact, I think that results in under-educating the kids.
Leora Druckmann from Ann Arbor, Michigan, has a different bone to pick. She says our story on the big business behind bar and bat mitzvahs was misleading. At her congregation, at least, the focus is on the community, not the party.
To focus on a few over-the-top bar mitzvah parties, which in no way represent most bar or bat mitzvah ceremonies, is to focus on values of materialism, a perspective which reinforces negative stereotypes of Jews.
Former wrestler Matt Alford in Portland, Oregon, took issue with a different kind of stereotype that mixed martial arts is all bare-knuckled brawling. I spoke with Sports Illustrated writer John Wertheim about the sport last week, and although John did say that mixed martial arts is becoming increasingly popular, Matt Alford, for one, thinks it's ready for more.
We've seen over time that other sports have been adopted into the Olympics, and I think it's worthy of being there along with wrestling and boxing and the other martial arts as well.
We made another comparison last week that rubbed some people the wrong way. We were talking about nationalizing banks, and we made reference to the post office's sometimes spotty customer service record. Eileen Klinkenbeard from Lake Forest, California, cried foul.
He said something about, yeah, how would you like the U.S. post office running your bank? Well, as far as I'm concerned, I think they could do a lot better job of it than what's been demonstrated recently.
And finally, a correction. Yesterday, commentator Todd Buchholz said this.
There's a scene in The Godfather when hot-headed Sonny Corleone gets whacked by two thugs. The senior thug turns to the younger and says, "Leave the gun, take the cannoli."
As the many, many Godfather fans out there pointed out, wrong. Sonny died at a toll booth in a hail of machine gun fire. Paulie Gatto was the guy getting whacked with cannoli nearby. If you've got other corrections or
an offer we cannot refuse.
Yeah, no, I'm just no good at that. You know where to go. Our website is marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. you spend your money says a lot about you. Some of us like the immediacy of cash, feel the pain now, not later. Others prefer the cushion of credit, and that cushion is what credit card companies count on. Behavioral economist Dan Ariely says it skews our perception of the spending. Dan, good to have you back with us.
Same here.
So, Dan, it is all just plastic, right? So what's the relationship between our perception of plastic money and real money?
It turns out that credit cards have very important psychological factors that they tap into. And because of that, they actually make us spend more money. The first one is something called the pain of paying. So think about the following. Imagine that you finished a meal and you pay at the end of the meal with either credit card or with cash. Which one do you find more painful?
Oh, cash, no question about it, right? Because plastic is just plastic.
So it turns out that the big reason for this is that the timing of payment and consumption is different all of a sudden. So to think about it, imagine that I had a restaurant and I decide to give you a great discount today. Every bite would only be 50 cents. And not only that, I will only charge you for the bites you take. So I will sit next to you with my little notebook, and every time you take a bite, I will mark a V on my notebook and charge you 50 cents for that bite. How much fun will that meal be?
Yeah, not very much fun, and it's going to be short too, because I'm going to take like 4 bites and I'm going to be done.
So what this tells us is that when it comes to payment, if you pay and consume at the same time, every bite is 50 cents, it creates pain of paying and therefore making the experience not as pleasant. From that perspective, credit cards are very effective in reducing the pain of paying. But there's another trick for credit cards. And the second trick is based on the idea that we think about money in terms of percentages, not in terms of absolute numbers. So here's a simple example. Imagine you were faced with the question of whether you want to buy a pen for $15, and the salesperson tells you you can buy the same pen, the same exact pen, instead of for $15 for $8 if you walk 5 blocks down the street. Would you do it?
It depends on how I'm feeling, but maybe.
How about if you were buying a suit for $1,015 and the guy said that you can buy the same suit for $7 less, for $1,008 if you walk 5 blocks down the road?
Would you walk? No, not a chance. I stay right where I am.
And that's because we think about money in percentages, not in absolute levels.
But you know what, though? I will drive an extra mile and a half to save 4 cents on a gallon of gas.
Gallon of gas and gasoline in general has become such an important part of what we think of ourselves and the efficiency and so on, that it has a slightly different rules to it. And everybody also has different ways to indicate to themselves that they are financially frugal and reasonable, and this might be gas for you. But in general, we think about money in terms of percentages. This is why you might look at tomatoes for a long time, thinking about whether you should buy the ones that are 20 cents cheaper. But when it comes to remodeling a house, you would spend another $20,000 without twitching at all. Now, credit cards in some way are like that. You have a big balance already, $1,500. So spending $100 more is just a small part of it. So with all of those factors, the pain of paying and the relativity, the percentage in thinking about money makes credit card much more powerful tools that get us to spend much more money.
So to wrap this up on a personal note, I have to ask you how many credit cards you have in your wallet right now.
I have one credit card and one debit card.
Oh, well, there you go.
Not too many. And I try to be reasonable about it.
He tries to be reasonable. Sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book on the subject is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Given what Dan just told us, this next number is probably not going to surprise you. We have collectively racked up a $900 billion credit card bill in this country. Given the way the economy is going, it's not at all clear who's going to pay for that. Millions of consumers don't have the cash to settle their debts. There's talk credit card defaults might set off the next wave of the financial crisis. And that has left banks scrambling to reinvent the most profitable part of their business and trying to convince people, the ones who still have good credit anyway, that plastic can be their friend. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
In Midtown Manhattan, product manager Brad Winicky is buying a black and white cookie and a bottle of water with his credit card.
My wife and I typically put pretty much everything but our rent on our credit card.
Winicky used to have a card that earned frequent flyer miles. Now he uses a cash back card, so every time he charges something, he gets a little bit of money back.
Sure, I just saved 2 cents.
And these days, savings is sexy. And virtuous credit cards like Brad's are one way banks are repitching plastic now that debt is a four-letter word.
The Discover Motiva card. When you pay your bill on time 6 months in a row, you get the next month's interest back as a cash reward.
Your cash back appears each month on your statement automatically.
So call now for the fee-free Simply Cash business card.
Did you get that? The more you charge, the better off you are? There's Visa's new Nest Eggs card and Fidelity Investments Retirement Rewards card. Both deposit 2% of what you spend into a retirement account. Charles Schwab's Invest First card funnels 2% into a Schwab brokerage account. Company spokesman Richard Musi says the cards have been a success.
The take-up rate has been tremendous. The volume of inquiries and customer accounts has greatly exceeded our expectations.
Credit cards have offered cash rewards before, but these new cards are attached to savings plans, and consumers can earn back roughly twice as much as they used to. Ken Wilber is a marketing professor at USC. He says credit card companies are shifting towards these virtuous cards to attract more upscale and financially stable customers.
The card companies move up market and compete harder for those previously less profitable customers who had better credit and were less likely to carry a balance.
In other words, the customers they used to ignore in favor of people who were less responsible with their credit. Remember, card companies pulled in a fortune in interest charges and late fees from people who spent more than they could afford to pay back. And before the economy crumbled, no one was too young or too risky to qualify for a card.
There's no credit check. Everyone is eligible to sign up. You don't even need a bank account.
And a credit card for you.
I love shopping.
You never run out of money.
And if you did run out of money, you could tap your home equity line to pay your credit card bills. That's what many homeowners did for years. Then the housing market collapsed and those lines of credit dried up. That's left credit card companies scrambling to save their business model. Robert Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation.
The credit card is the most profitable line right now in the banking industry, and they need to squeeze it for everything they can get.
So, Manning says, credit cards are cutting back on benefits like free rental car insurance and purchase protection, and they're charging fees for things that used to be free, like redeeming your rewards. They're also punishing risky customers with smaller credit lines and higher interest rates. To figure out just who is a risky customer, Manning says card companies are hiring data mining consultants to identify cardholders who live in low-income neighborhoods or shop at deep discount stores. The thinking is you're more likely to have trouble paying your bills if you live in an area where foreclosures are rising or shop with people who are behind on their card payments.
We're talking about risk assessment that's not based on your personal behavior, but now you've got to be blamed about the person in line in front or behind you, whether they're paying their bills on time. This is absolutely extraordinary and outrageous.
And likely to continue as more people default on their credit cards and as card companies do whatever they can to make sure plastic keeps paying off. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today to wrap things up in pretty much the same place we started, bank lending. Citigroup announced today it's gotten the government's message loud and clear. It's going to start handing out a good chunk of the bailout money it has been given, $36.5 billion of the $45 billion all told, to be specific, mostly to government-backed loan programs. As for the story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, that Citi is considering pulling out of its naming rights deal for the new stadium for baseball's New York Mets, not true, a Citi spokeswoman told us today, although if you add it up, the savings would only be about $20 million a year on top of all those billions in losses. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow hiked up 141 points, 1.7%. The NASDAQ added 21 points, nearly 1.5%. The S&P 500 rose 13 points, about 1.5% there as well. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, Waging War from Thousands of Miles Away.
You're going to war for 12 hours, shooting weapons at targets, directing kills on enemy combatants. And then you get in the car and you drive home. And within 20 minutes, you're sitting at the dinner table talking to your kids about their homework.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.